Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Culture Lab. I'm Christy Taylor. This is the show all about how science plays out in our cultural creations. Sometimes we talk about popular TV and movies. Other times we talk to artists and authors about the research that influenced their works. Elizabeth Colbert has been covering climate change for decades. You may know her for her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, where she explores, to a devastating degree, the ways in which human activities have fundamentally changed our planet. More recently, she's focused explicitly on climate change as a columnist for The New Yorker. Her 2021 book, Under a White Sky, explores the complications and risks of relying too heavily on technology solutions, like solar geoengineering, which would involve injecting particles into the atmosphere that could temporarily stop temperatures from rising, but not the CO2 itself. Her newest book is H's for Hope. It's simpler in many ways, a richly illustrated series of essays that tackles its subjects in alphabetical order. A is for Arrhenius, the scientist who created the first ever world climate model. B is for blah, 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 activist Greta Thunberg's disparagement of the frustrating pace of political dialogue, and so on. I spoke to Elizabeth about the book and what it means to tell stories about the moment we are in as a species. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. What went into the decision to put hope as the title, the header for this book?
Well, I think, you know, at the time and even now, I don't think it's going anywhere. There's a lot of questions of how we should be telling this narrative. And one of the sort of themes of the book is what's the sort of role of narrative in motivating action or demotivating action, I suppose. And that's another question that I was playing with in the book or looking at from different sides in the book. And H is for Hope is the title, but that is, you know, just one letter, you know, obviously a very key letter, but, you know, we can, depending on what you take from the book, hope is a choice. I mean, there's a very, I quote Christiana Figueres, who makes that point very strongly in the book.
Last year was the warmest on record. This year could be even warmer, depending on how sort of the El Nino patterns play out. But how do you describe or summarize the point at which we've arrived in experiencing the changing of the planet? And what are the stakes?
Well, I mean, honestly, it's kind of surreal to watch. You know, I wrote exactly sort of 20 years ago, I embarked on writing a three-part series. It was reported in 2004. You know, at that point, you still had a lot of scientists on the ground even who were saying, oh, I'm not sure, you know, maybe this will flip around, you know. Field scientists, the climate modelers were, you know, convinced this is only heading in one direction. And, you know, most people were not probably feeling climate change in their own lives. And the whole sort of idea behind writing this series was, okay, this is coming at us. This is, you know, a freight train coming at us. People really ought to be aware of what's coming at us. And then to watch that freight train arrive and everyone just sort of stand there. And, you know, I guess according to this metaphor, they would have been run over by the freight train, but we haven't quite been run over by the freight train, but we seem to be intent on just standing on the tracks and watching as, you know, every scientist in the world, you know, says, oh my God, and hideous fire seasons, hideous, you know, flooding, all of the predictions, just all watching them come true. It's kind of mind-blowingly weird on some level, just like how did this species, you know, last for so long, they can't even react to, you know, pretty clear and present danger.
We are also now at a point where the Paris Agreement target of 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming seems difficult, if not impossible, to meet. The next benchmark or goal was to keep warming well below 2 degrees Celsius. Do these numbers mean anything at this point? You know, is there something else we should be looking to instead?
Well, they certainly mean something, you know, and I mean, at the time that Paris was signed, you know, anyone who was being honest about it would have said, we're not going to hit 1.5, you know, it required radical drops in emissions at a time when many countries' emissions were and are continuing to grow quite steeply. So, you know, that was always sort of a stretch goal. It was put in there to kind of appease countries that are going to get wiped off the map by climate change. And, you know, the fact that we're sailing by it is not surprising, but the way we're kind of sailing by it is perhaps even more distressing than, you know, than I expected, and the margin by which we're sailing by it. Now, the next, as you say, the next kind of target is 2 degrees. That's still, you know, theoretically possible, but requires immense, massive global mobilization of a sort that we have yet to see. And if you look at, you know, all the projects that are on the books, all the fossil fuel projects that are in the works, it's very hard. Those cannot be reconciled with limiting warming to 2 degrees.
In H is for Hope, you tell the story of technologies and projects that are underway. What particularly caught my eye, green concrete, you got to ride in an electric airplane. There were, you know, major advances in wind turbine projects. There's an iron battery someone's working on that works by rusting. So are we on track to have all the technology we need to reach net zero emissions fairly quickly?
Well, I think that we have what we need to make a really quite a big dent in emissions. Do we have what we need to get all the way to, you know, quote unquote net zero? Possibly not. But that's really not no excuse for not getting as far down that trend line as we can. And I think one of the points, one of the hopeful points that people would make is, you know, as you're doing, making these changes, things will happen. I mean, innovation sort of breeds innovation. And if we were really pushing on that, we would develop things a lot faster than if we just sat there and said, well, let's just wait and see if someone comes up with something. That's not a plan.
Are there technologies, you know, that said, that feel sort of the most promising or the most likely to sort of breed the kind of innovation that will maybe get us across the finish line?
Well, I mean, one, you know, where are there big gaps? Well, so we know how to produce low emissions, low carbon electricity. And in fact, you know, as a result of just expansion of wind and solar, electricity is no longer the biggest, and reducing our use of coal, electricity is no longer the biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. Transportation has overtaken it. We also know how to do, you know, we know how to make electric cars. We know how to make fuel cell cars. One things that we don't know how to do or don't know how to do very well at this point are, you know, these processes that go into making things like electric cars, you know, smelting, you know, aluminum and, you know, just very high energy intensive industrial processes. You mentioned concrete. Concrete production is very energy intensive. It also, in the way that we make concrete now, by definition, produces CO2 because of heating up limestone and releasing CO2. So those blocks, those chunks, those big industrial processes chunks, you know, definitely were not there. But I will say, you know, in the Inflation Reduction Act, there's a lot of money to pursue different avenues that might get us at least part of the way there. Some of those avenues will result in dead ends, but some of them might not.
I notice you haven't mentioned solar geoengineering, something you wrote an entire book about, and which seems to be picking up steam in ways that, you know, people are talking about more, modeling more. Personally, I find it frightening to conceive of that kind of step, but, you know, is too long a delay in meaningful action going to put us, I guess, at risk of trying something riskier?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. We're in very, I don't think people appreciate, honestly, including your listeners and readers of New Scientist, how dangerous the situation is. There are a lot of unknowns here. There are a lot of knowns that are bad, and there are a lot of unknowns that could turn out to be, you know, very bad. And we're in a situation now where we're kind of depending on luck. Like, we're hoping that this figure called, you know, climate sensitivity, we're hoping it's not on the high end. If it is on the high end, you know, we've already guaranteed, you know, a phenomenally difficult world for us, for ourselves to live in, and for many other species to live in. And as was pointed out to me by the guy studying geoengineering when I wrote Under a White Sky, there's no way, no one has come up with a way at this point to do anything quickly, right? Reducing emissions does not change your climate. It simply, you know, prevents it from getting worse or slows down the rate at which it's getting worse. Besides geoengineering, that's the only thing, solar geoengineering, that's the only technology people have come up with. It's still basically a theoretical technology. But we know it works because, or we know that the theory works because it's what happens when a volcano goes off and spews a lot of reflective material into the stratosphere, and we get global cooling temporarily.
And I just want to go back and can you unpack the sensitivity term you just used? You know, what does it signify?
Yeah, so climate sensitivity refers to, it's usually used, you know, for sensitivity, let's say the climate sensitivity to doubled CO2. If you doubled the amount of CO2 that was in the atmosphere compared with pre-industrial days, what kind of a temperature difference would you get out ultimately? And there are different timescales you could look at what kind of temperature you get out fairly rapidly and what kind of temperature increase you get out in the long term as the world reaches a new equilibrium. And that is a figure that scientists have had a really, really, really hard time narrowing the uncertainty. And so the range is still quite large. And if it's on the high end, you know, then we sort of probably have already guaranteed at least 2 degrees worth of warming. And if it's on the low end, you know, then we haven't, or middle end. And so that figure, you know, to have such a huge unknown at the center of the conversation is, it should be terrifying to people.
I want to talk more about those unknowns because you wrote a piece pretty recently about how the ocean temperatures last year, they smashed record after record. Climatologists have been expressing concern that these heat waves in the ocean suggest something is missing from our current climate models. And as you wrote, these temperatures in the oceans may also suggest we do not fully understand how fast the climate is changing. So I'd love you to unpack this more. Why is this so strange?
Yeah, so about a year ago, once again, pretty much exactly a year ago, scientists started to notice, or you don't have to notice, there's, you know, very sophisticated buoys out there, and we're satellite measurements, we're always measuring sea surface temperatures, and that globally sea surface temperatures were just climbing into shocking new heights. And then we got an El Nino, then that usually warms things up. But the temperatures had already started to warm before the El Nino began. So that really caught people's attention. And then they just have stayed or even, you know, breached record after record after record. And the question is, and it's a pretty basic one, what is going on here, right? So you would obviously expect in a warming world and in a warming world with an El Nino on top of it, you would expect high temperatures, but you wouldn't expect this kind of a jump. This is just a jump that climate scientists are having a hard time explaining. And, you know, one of the questions, as you alluded to, is, you know, are we missing something? And one of the points that one very prominent climate scientist, Gavin Schmidt, made to me was, does a warming world just behave differently from the previous world? And if that's true, you know, we are in a much warmer world. I mean, once again, people may not appreciate that, but from a sort of geological perspective, we have raised the temperature of the world quite a bit and quite rapidly. And if it turns out that that world behaves differently, then once again, sort of all bets are off. We don't really know. We can't even rely on our climate models, which are bad enough, you know, as many people have pointed out. Now we're in also, once again, this sort of, you will hear this a lot, we are in uncharted territory. We just are not sure.
In fact, in your book, the letter U is for uncertainty,
which is not just for these models and their unknown unknowns, but also the fact that our climate is leaving a period of relative stability for one that may in fact fluctuate wildly before settling on perhaps, you know, something stable. People say the words new normal a lot when we're looking at how things have changed. And I find that extremely uncomfortable in a lot of ways because, you know, as you've said, we're leaving one point of stability, but we haven't yet reached a new stable point to call normal. And you end actually that section with the question, how can we prepare for a future we can't imagine? So I actually want to turn that question back to you. How can we prepare for a future we can't imagine?
I should, you know, preface this by saying if I had the answer to that, you know, if I had an answer to a question like that, I would run for president, though I probably wouldn't win. But it's a little bit like my answer to the question about, you know, do we have the technologies to get all the way to net zero? We don't have the ability to plan for events that we can't anticipate, that our models don't anticipate. But we are not even getting ready for what our models tell us is, and what, you know, basic science of, you know, warmer water takes up more space than cold water. You know, a lot of sea level rise is just what's called a thermal expansion of water. We have pretty good idea that we're getting, you know, X amount of sea level rise, you know, within the next few decades. And, you know, some places are starting to sort of prepare for that, but most are not. And many, many countries, I should also add, lack the resources to do that. So, you know, we are in a super difficult situation, but for the sort of developed world that does have a lot of resources, we are not in the US. You know, we are still having, you know, stupid fights in a lot of states over whether we should be able to talk about climate change in your planning. You know, I mean, it's just absurd. So there's a lot that we should be doing that we're not doing, that we know we should be doing. And then when we get to the question, well, how can you plan for things that we just can't even anticipate? You know, then the answer is, well, you need to try to build as much robustness into the system as you can and as much flexibility as you can. That's easy to say. You know, the word resilience is bandied around a lot. When you have, you know, in case of New York City, let's say 8 million people sitting in a place that, you know, maybe you shouldn't have 8 million people, that's really hard to, you know, just say, okay, just make that more resilient.
Jewelry isn't a gift you give just once. It's a way to remind your loved one of a beautiful moment every time they see it. Blue Nile can help you find the gift that says how you feel and says it beautifully, with expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com and experience the convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com to find the perfect jewelry gift for any occasion. BlueNile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Are there other extremes besides the oceans, which we already talked about, but of temperature, of, you know, emissions, other sorts of measures that we should be paying attention to that maybe are not getting the same kind of press?
You know, ocean temperatures, I would say, are a good one to pay attention to because, you know, oceans are absorbing most of the heat, 90% of the extra heat that we have generated, as it were. So the ocean sea surface temperatures are telling us a lot. What should we also be paying attention to? You know, now we're getting a little bit into the weeds, but one big figure that climate scientists pay a lot of attention to is the energy imbalance figure. So that is, the world is warming because we are no longer emitting back to space as much energy. Earth has to be in energy balance with space. This is, you know, sort of black body radiation. You know, you learn in a sort of basic geophysics course, but we are not in balance. We are absorbing more energy than we are re-emitting back to space. And that can be measured in the different wavelengths of radiation that are, you know, arriving and leaving. And I'm not going to claim to be an expert on this in any way, but scientists track that what is the energy imbalance? And, you know, we are not in energy balance. And so your point earlier that we are not in a new normal, you will not reach a new normal, you know, if you ever do, until the world is back in equilibrium with space. And that will not happen until we, A, stop emitting greenhouse gases, and B, you know, sort of depending on the dynamics of the system, until it reaches a new equilibrium, which on some level will not happen for many hundreds, even thousands of years.
What else do you think people don't necessarily understand about climate change, about the crisis we're facing and in many places are already in?
Well, I think, and once again, this is not based on social science research, so I am sort of just one person offering a theory, but I think that people don't appreciate the cumulative nature of climate change, that there's this idea that it's like a lot of other problems that we faced, smog, you know, once we finally got our act together and put catalytic converters on cars, you know, smog, you know, very pretty quickly and very noticeably, you know, declined. So there are a lot, most of the problems that we've been used to dealing with, acid rain, you know, once we got the sulfur out of coal and cleaned up our fuel, we, you know, dramatically changed that trajectory. So there are a lot of problems that you can address, and pretty quickly you'll see good results. But climate change is not one of those problems. It's a problem that once you put something up there, it basically sits there for all intents and purposes, you know, forever. And so I think people sort of feel like when we start bending that emissions curve, which may happen, you know, globally, even in the next several years, we may see a flattening out at least of global emissions. That is not doing us, you know, I don't want to diminish that. That's useful, but it's not really doing us any good. We're continuing to emit at a very high level. And every year that we do that, we guarantee more warming. I think that people don't understand that this is people make the bathtub comparison. You know, we are filling this bathtub and we are not emptying it. And once it's full, you know, and starts to overflow, then you're in trouble.
As you mentioned earlier, you've been covering climate for decades now. Has your attitude and understanding of this crisis changed in that time?
Well, I think when I started out, you know, people thought, well, we just have to, you know, sort of turn around. It's a super tanker. It has to be, you know, turned around, but it can be turned around. And, you know, people had different ways for, you know, certainly, you know, hoping to stabilize global emissions, that global emissions could be stabilized at a certain level. Well, we shot past every, you know, one of those markers really fast and much earlier than people thought. For example, when I first started out, it was estimated or projected that China would overtake the US as the leading greenhouse gas emitter. I think it was around 2020. It actually happened in 2006. And China's emissions, you know, once again, the US remains the world's historically biggest emitter. So the US bears a great deal of responsibility, you know, numero uno in the responsibility queue. But China's emissions have just grown phenomenally, just shockingly, so that China is now, you know, emitting, I don't know, something like a third of the global carbon. And that's a huge issue, unfortunately. And, you know, another theme in Ages for Hope is that, you know, this is a global problem. It's not something that any one country can solve on its own. And it's not something but everyone will suffer from it. So that's a very, very unusual problem and a very difficult problem.
Well, and at the Conference of Parties this last year, we saw progress towards actually, you know, you alluded to this, but the sort of injustice of who emits versus who suffers the most and most immediately, you know, in terms of shifting money towards the countries that are on the verge of being underwater already, for example.
No, there's a great sort of callousness in the developed world. You know, if people were getting, you know, shot or whatever, we would be outraged or whatever. But we ourselves, you could argue, you know, just by doing very ordinary things, and this is another part of the complexity or the daunting nature of the problem, you know, it's not by doing outrageous things, it's by, you know, driving to work or whatever, that we are all contributing to this problem.
Well, and so in terms of global policy, you know, if we're looking at sort of the planetary scale, what else is there to be done?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think that there's a couple points. One would be, you know, does the developed world, you know, owe some form of restitution to the developing world? That's, once again, resources. Should it be for its own sake? I would argue the developed world should be very interested in trying to encourage and finance the developing world, developing in a different way from the way that we developed. So that, I think, is huge. That's, once again, resources. Those are not necessarily always financial resources, but they are, you know, what's called technology transfer, but also a lot of capital. I will say we do get back to resources because, you know, building up an energy infrastructure or transitioning your energy infrastructure, depending on where you are in that sort of development curve, those are very capital intensive projects. And the developing world is rightly outraged that a lot of capital from the developed world is not flowing into that.
You mentioned driving to work. Are there choices you as an individual make differently because of your work and understanding of the climate crisis?
Yes, absolutely. But I do want to say I'm someone who travels a lot for work. You know, I, you know, fly, which is a terribly carbon intensive thing to do. So I never hold myself up as, you know, a person who has in her own life is to be emulated, because I know that I have a very high carbon footprint. But, you know, yeah, I can't see them, but I have, you know, solar array that really provides, you know, all of our power here. You know, I drive an electric hybrid car, you know, the usual things that one does, that one can do if one lives in a certain, you know, part of the world. You know, it's hard to do, obviously, if you're living in an apartment, you can't put solar panels up on the roof. But, you know, choices about eating, all of those things I do try to be mindful of. But I am also, as I say, acutely aware that I am not, you know, walking the walk.
Well, and I think your answer sort of exemplifies some of the contradictions that many of us may feel in terms of trying to act as individuals while also understanding that there's a lot outside of our control that, you know, is up to policymakers and people with capital, as you reference. How do you sit with those things that you can't control, with the things that, you know, other people are ultimately deciding on our behalf?
Well, that's a good question. I also don't want to say, I mean, it is a choice for me. I could say, and I've contemplated it, you know, you could say, well, I'm just not participating, right? To a certain extent, we could all say that. Now it would, you know, cost me my job, I suppose, in a certain extent. But you know, I could do it. So I think it's a very complicated question. I don't think it's as simple as there are things that are not in our control and there are things that are in our control. I also happen to know that, you know, decarbonizing flight is going to be extremely difficult. You know, so that does that mean the whole way we live should change? Yes, it probably does, to be honest. Am I going to, you know, say, well, I'm going to personally just opt out? And a lot of people have, and it's especially true in Europe, you know, where people have taken no flying pledges. It's a lot easier to get around by train. One of the things we lack in this country is a decent public transportation system. So all of these are really, really complicated questions. And while I certainly believe that it's absolutely essential that we have better policies in place and make very, very profound system-wide changes, I also do think that it's true that we probably can't just swap out our energy systems and live exactly as we live now and get anywhere close to net zero.
I want to come back to hope. You quote Pliny in the book saying that hope is the pillar that holds up the world. You also write strikingly briefly in D is for Despair that despair is unproductive and also a sin. And I want to add my favorite quote about hope, which is from Rebecca Solnit, that hope isn't something you wait for, but this is a paraphrase, an axe you use to break down a door, for example, in a burning building. Finally, in N is for Narratives, you add that communications researchers recommend that instead of doom and gloom, fear-mongering narratives, we need stories, quote, that empower people to act. So What are the emotions, the attitudes, the narratives that you think we will find most helpful in facing the choices ahead and the hardships that are already occurring around the world?
Well, I am going to punt on that question because one of the sort of, I don't want to say points of the book, but one thing that I hope comes through in the book is there are many legitimate and honest even ways of reacting. You know, as a journalist, I feel my obligation is to present you with, you know, information's narratives and how you choose to respond. I have no control over, you know, I'm not a social scientist. I'm not out there saying, you know, giving you three different narratives to read and saying, which of these do you find the most is going to inspire you to act or despair or whatever. So I don't have a view on what is most productive. You know, I was speaking the other day somewhere about this book, Ages for Hope, and someone said, well, I want people to be afraid. It was a kid, a young kid, you know, 15 years old or something. I want people to be afraid. I'm afraid. And I was like, yeah, I mean, fear is a motivator. I don't necessarily buy into, you know, that we should, and people have described it as hopium. You know, that's another phrase that's out there, you know, just, oh, everything's going to be okay. You know, fear is a motivator. You know, when we mobilized for World War II, we were scared. And unfortunately, we need a kind of wartime mobilization. What gets people to do that? Is it fear? Is it hope? I don't know.
Then let me end with stories, since you are a journalist, as you said. What are the stories that you think will be most important to tell and pay attention to in the next few years? Are they technology stories? Are they policy stories? Are they mitigation stories? Are they something else I'm not thinking of?
Well, you know, all of the above. I mean, I do think there's a tendency, because we're a very tech-happy society and we are looking, as it were, for easy fixes in a way, that, you know, every new technology that comes along that someone says, you know, this is it. I mean, how many headlines have been, is this going to save us? You know, it's like, well, you know, no. But I think that, unfortunately, a lot of what needs to happen in the next several years here in the US, I'm speaking for the US, but I think I speak broadly for, you know, the developed world, is very nitty gritty policy choices. And they have huge ramifications. And, you know, to go back to air travel, for example, there are tax credits there are tax credits in the Inflation Reduction Act for what's called sustainable aviation fuel. There's a big fight over what constitutes sustainability, surprise, surprise. And there are a lot of people worried that if you write the regs the wrong way, you will actually be encouraging, you know, things that are actually even worse than jet fuel is now. So, you know, that kind of nitty gritty policy choice that tends to interest only the affected industries, unfortunately, they are going to be super important. And now I'm also just talking about, you know, if we have a second Biden administration, I'm not even getting into what's going to happen if we have a Trump administration.
Well, then I think the last question is just, what did I miss, you know, about the book, about anything that feels pressing or important in your work right now?
Well, I mean, the one thing I want to say about the book, which has, I want to give a shout out to the illustrator, Wesley Osbrook, who did, you know, beautiful, really beautiful illustrations. And one of the sort of hopes of the book, of Age for Hope, is, you know, I do think that people, you know, don't read things. There should be a certain pleasure in reading, even, you know, even reading about a very dark subject. People have to pick up a book. And I hope that between the illustrations and some of the narratives, which I think are funny or provocative or whatever, I hope they are, I wanted to make a reading experience that was actually enjoyable, even as conveying some, you know, pretty heavy stuff.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Elizabeth.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Culture Lab from New Scientist Podcasts. That was Pulitzer Prize-winning science journalist Elizabeth Colbert. Her newest book is called H is for Hope. If you liked this interview, make sure you subscribe to our feed for more like it, plus our weekly news podcast and the mayhem-infused Dead Planet Society. All that drops right here every Friday and Tuesday. Find more journalism from New Scientist on our website at newscientist.com. I'm Christy Taylor. Bye for now.
This podcast is produced by OG Podcasts. Find out more at ogpodcasts.co.uk.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.